Good morning. It's good to be back with you. I missed you all last week. Am I good? All right, I want you to look forward. I don't want you to look at anybody to your right or to your left, but I want to share something with you. There is a sin you can catch from other people. Some of you did it anyway. You started looking down the pew. But it's really true. There is a sin you can catch from other people. We're going to look at it. It's in Numbers 11. Please grab a Bible, and you'll want to see this. It's on page 119 if you want to use a pew Bible. Before we get there, I just want to remind you a little bit about why we're studying the Old Testament. And I've said several times and pointed you to that verse in Corinthians where Paul told the recipient of that letter, these things in the Old Testament were written for our instruction. They were written as examples to us. So the Old Testament is for us. But I want to show you another verse I haven't pointed you to. After Jesus rose from the dead, he's on his way to a place called Emmaus, or there's two of his disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they're walking along talking about everything that happened, not aware that he rose from the dead. Jesus shows up, starts walking with them, amazes them with all he knows, and then he reveals himself to them. Says, I'm the one. And then Jesus says this, it says this about Jesus. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So with these two guys, Jesus started at Genesis and went through the whole Old Testament showing them where he was in the Old Testament. Numbers 11, Jesus is all over it. Jesus is in Numbers 11. And if I can remember, and I sure hope I can, I'm going to show you Jesus in Numbers 11. And it is a beautiful, wonderful picture. I'm sure he showed it to these two disciples. Just to give you some background, Numbers 11, they finished over 400 years of awful slavery in Egypt. God delivered them miraculously, supernaturally, with 10 horrendous plagues on the Egyptians, the last one being the angel of death, delivering the Israelites with the Passover and the blood over their door. Then God miraculously parted the Red Sea and destroyed Pharaoh's army in it. It was incredible. By the time you get to Numbers 11, you're about a year out from that incredible experience of being saved. And some problems start. Actually, problems started about 3 days after they got through the Red Sea. They made a golden calf, and, well, we won't even go there. But this is about a year away from that. And you see another problem, this sin that you can catch from other people. Let's start at verse 1. The first three verses is a section in itself. And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. And the people cried out to Moses. And Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So that the name of the place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Say, preacher, I don't like that. I don't either. But it's going to get a lot worse. But that just seems, it was hard. That place you're looking at on the map, it's a horrible place. It's a desert. There's nothing there. And it's hot. It doesn't grow anything. And they'd been there a year. But it gets worse. Now look at verse 4. Now the rabble that was among them. Here's where the real trouble starts. Folks, especially in a church, most of the problems in a church start with spiritual immaturity. That's the rabble, all right, if you will. The rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. They didn't have any meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance was like that of the lily. And the people went out about and gathered it and ground it in handmills, or beat it in mortars, or boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. And when the dew fell upon the camp, the manna fell with it. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent. And look at this last part of verse 10. And the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. So, what happened? Well, a few days after they were saved from Egypt and miraculously brought through the Red Sea, they started running out of food. They could only carry so much. It was a desert. There was no grocery stores or anything like that where they could get food. Folks, the Bible says there were about 600,000 men in this group. That's not counting the women and children. You can't feed that many people in the desert. They started running out of food. They complained. God heard their, and of course they complained. God heard their complaint, and this is back then, Exodus 16:4. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not." So God said, "I'm going to solve the problem. I'm going to make it easy for them. I'm going to rain bread from heaven." And he did it 6 days a week. And on the sixth day, they got enough for the seventh day. And it's exactly what he did. But you see, he did it to test them. And he did this over and over and over again. I was thinking about this. Think about this. That is every single day them getting up and seeing God intervene in their life supernaturally. Every 6 days a week. And enough on the sixth day for the seventh. I think that would be incredibly encouraging. I try to read my Bible every day. Sometimes I feel like I hear a word from the Lord. Sometimes it's uplifting and encouraging. Sometimes it's not. It's just some words that I'm reading. But this was every single day a sign from God. But they got tired of it. Now, some of you are already sympathizing with them. As I was reading this, I thought, well, I can understand that. I don't like to eat the... I could probably eat bacon every day, but I don't like to eat the same thing over and over again and nothing else. And so you start to sympathize with them. But I want you to see something. Moses did not sympathize. More importantly, God did not sympathize with them. God did not say, "Oh yeah, you're right, it's too boring of a diet." And folks, the author actually refutes their complaint. They say it's terrible and it's boring and all we have is this manna to look at. And the author reminds them how good it is. It looked good. Even the appearance of it was pretty. And that bdellium, that was something that was right outside the Garden of Eden. It was a very special thing they used a lot. It was precious and that's what it looked like. But there were lots of ways they could use it. You see the different ways they could make it. And it's interesting that it says I like the way the Christian Standard Bible puts it. It tasted like a pastry cooked with the finest oil. Look, it might have looked like porridge, but apparently it tasted more like donuts. All right? No, I'm serious. The finest cake made with flour. And people, I just can't resist this. You know, this is where banana bread came from. And manicotti. I tried it. I thought it would be funny. But listen, the author refutes their complaints. They didn't have to pay for it. It wasn't boring. It could be made in all these different ways. And I want you to see that, and God supplied it for them, but they wanted to go back to Egypt. They were looking back at Egypt with rose-colored glasses. You see what it says? We remember verse 5. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt. It cost nothing. And the cucumbers and the melons. Everything was wonderful in Egypt. It was just a big buffet. And I went back and looked at what they said while they were in Egypt. It's in Exodus 2:23. And during those many days, the king of Egypt died. And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. They were miserable in Egypt. And they begged God to give them some relief. But they had forgotten about that. And they got tired of what God was providing for them. I want to show you something else, another description of this man. And you may think, I can sympathize with him. Be careful. Look how the psalmist describes it. Yet God commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, and he rained down on them manna to eat and gave them, what? The grain of heaven. Man ate the bread of angels. It's the original angel food cake. That's the last joke I will try. But seriously, the bread of heaven, he sent them the food in abundance. Folks, this stuff was awesome. Think about the wedding at Cana in John chapter 2, Jesus' first public miracle where he created wine. And the head waiter, he was amazed. Why? Because it was the good stuff. Usually whoever was running the wedding would give them the good stuff at the beginning, but when everybody's senses were dulled, they'd give them the cheap stuff. And the waiter was amazed because this was the good stuff. God doesn't create any junk. I love the pictures of Jesus healing in the Old Testament. He'd heal a lame man, and the guy would get up, and he wouldn't walk away with a cane or a walker. He would jump up, and he would run away. And when he healed people, blind people, they didn't need glasses or contact lenses. Their vision was perfect. God doesn't do anything. He sent them food from heaven. He sent them food from angels. And they got tired of it. The sin was grumbling. And there was two ingredients to it. One was ingratitude. I think God was saying, you know, what I did for you in Egypt, what I did for you at the Red Sea, what I did for you at Sinai, that ought to be enough. And I'm feeding you every single day. And they grew ungrateful for it. The other ingredient to grumbling is unbelief. And that's the worst part of it. They were no longer believing God was perfectly good and God was looking out for them. And they no longer believed that God cared. And they didn't believe that God was going to complete his promise of bringing them to the promised land. The root of grumbling, which is contagious, is unbelief. They were no longer thinking God was so good. They were not satisfied with the way God was doing things, and it ultimately led them to reject God. Look at this. Look at verse 20. You, about halfway through, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we come out of Egypt? I wish God had left us alone. I wish he hadn't saved us. They were rejecting God. We better be careful not to forget the greatness of our salvation. The greatness of what happened to us the moment we accepted Jesus Christ. We better not forget the price he paid for our salvation. These people lost sight of their privilege. Wow, look what God bared his arm and went down there in a very strong and magnificent way and brought them out of slavery and promised them their own country and their own land flowing with milk and honey. They lost sight of the privilege of being God's chosen people. Imagine you're in the North Atlantic and you're halfway across and your ship sinks and you're out in the ocean. It's just minutes before you die of hypothermia and this fishing trawler comes up and plucks you from the ocean, saves your life, puts you in a room, and you start complaining about the towels not being softened. You know, the truth is, and I want to be very clear about this, the truth is, for a lot of people, becoming a Christian doesn't lead to an easier life. And Jesus never promised that. In fact, Jesus said, if you want to follow me, you better count the cost. Don't follow me unless you count the cost first. Why? There's two reasons. One, it's very expensive. You have to give up everything and everybody. If you want to follow me, it's expensive to follow Jesus. And for some people, it gets really, really hard. Sometimes when a person goes to follow Christ, their family gets a lot more unpleasant. And it divides family. And Jesus said, I came to divide families. Families will be divided because of me. Jesus said, count the cost because it's expensive. But you remember the other reason he told them to count the cost? Because if you count the cost of following Jesus, it
is worth it.
But they were looking at the cost, saying it wasn't. Grumbling is an unbelief that robs you of your joy. And the other thing they were forgetting, the wilderness wasn't their home. This wasn't the end of the line. God still got the whole promised land open to them. They were heading there. They could have been there in less than 2 years, inside the promised land, building their houses and enjoying it in less than 2 years. This was not their home. And folks, when things get rough, that's one thing to remember. What God, not only what He's done for you, but what He's got ahead of you. That's how faith conquers the temptation to grumble. Faith laughs at short rations and hardships because it remembers this is not all there is. The sin of murmuring, it's unbelief, and it's ingratitude. And then you see God's anger. And this is really what's hard for us. You see it at the end of verse 9, the anger of the Lord blazed hotly. And then Moses starts complaining. Moses says, I don't want this job. He says, I can't give these people meat. And Moses, and we won't go through all of it, but basically God tells Moses, you go tell the people, I'm going to give them meat. They want meat, I'll give them meat. Moses expressed some unbelief. He said, well, you can't do, there's 600,000 of them, there's no way. God said, my hand's not so short. I can do this. But God was so angry. Remember, He gave them the manna to test them. They were failing the test. He says, verse 20, they rejected it. God came near every single day, and they turned their back on it. He was in their midst, and they wished He would go away. He's come down, and they wanted Him to leave. It was supernatural intervention. God had given Israel a distinction and a privilege and a special calling, and they sneered at it. And they didn't hold it in high esteem. They reacted against it, and they turned their backs on their destiny. It got hard, and they didn't want it. I think of that verse in the New Testament where Jesus said, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. What does that mean? It means Jesus says, I told you it would be hard. But it's so much better than not knowing me. It's so much better than being a slave to sin. It's so much better than dying in your sin. It is temporary. But you've got to hang on to the plow and keep going. Well, God was very angry, and He makes that plain. Moses was angry. God deals with Moses. God gives Moses some help. He gives him 70 elders to help him. And He tells them in verse 18 what to tell the people. Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. And then look at verse 19. And you shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you. Because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before Him, saying, why did we come out of Egypt? You see Moses complain. The people from among whom I number 600,000 on foot, and you've said, I'll give them meat. They may eat a whole month. Moses says, we can't do that. Verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Verse 24, so Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. And he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent. So he's promised them meat. God is going to answer their prayer. Let's look at what happened. Verse 31. Then a wind from the Lord sprang up, and it brought quail from the sea. And it let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the ground. Verse 32, and the people rose all that day and all that night and all the next day and gathered the quail. And those who gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. Looked it up. As best we can figure these ancient measurements, 10 homers, that's the least amount anybody gathered. That would fill 2 55-gallon drums. That's a lot of meat. God doesn't do anything halfway. But then look at verse 33. While the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. And the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. Therefore, the name of that place was called Kibroth Hattaavah, because they buried the people who had the craving. And from that place, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. So, what was that? That was a combination of judgment, and it was a combination of grace. They did get the meat, but they had to know they had displeased God. Our salvation is amazing. What Jesus did on the cross, the Son of God, who never committed one single sin, taking on the sin of the world and enduring his Father's wrath. We should never, ever get over that. That should color everything we look at. Our salvation was free to us, but it was bought with a price. And if we complain in such a way that shows we're over it, or we lightly esteem it, or yeah, that was a long time ago, or I deserve to be saved, that is so wrong and so misguided. That's why this story was given to us. And so we need to look at the complaints we have. Does the complaint we have, do the things we complain about, does it show ingratitude to God? Does it show you really have forgotten what God's done? And you say, preacher, wait a minute. We studied about David all summer, the Summer of Psalms. Remember that? Did David complain? Yeah. He said, how long, God? I got enemies all around me. But he complained to God, but he never rejected God. He never disbelieved God. He let his pain be known. He's let his frustrations be known, but he never stopped trusting God. And he never doubted God's plan. He never turned his back on God. Do you see the difference? Moses was complaining here, but he was still seeking to please God. The people wanted to go back to the old life. They wanted to let go of the plow and go back to slavery in Egypt. That's a rejection. It's a huge difference. Does your complaint show ingratitude? Does what you're complaining about show spiritual immaturity? We talk about this a lot. The difference between spiritual maturity and spiritual immaturity. Mature people know what's important, right? Immature people, like children, they don't know what's important. The most important thing to this child tomorrow is that they get to use the purple crayon. Nothing else matters to them as much as that purple crayon. That's the one they want. And if they don't get the purple crayon, life is over. And so they scream. We all grow up. We all mature physically. Not everybody matures spiritually. You can have a person in their 60s, 70s, or 80s who is a spiritual baby, and they don't know the difference between what's important and what's not important. Make sure your complaints take into account the big picture. What are we here for? As a church, we're here to make disciples. We're here to see the gospel go from here to there, to the ends of the earth. That's the big picture. And there's all kinds of crayons that we deal with in the building and among ourselves, but they're just crayons. And if you're getting all upset about one of those, it's a sign of spiritual immaturity. And you say, well, preacher, what are some of the crayons? That would be a great topic for lunch today.
talk about what the purple crayons are. And I'll just say it. Be very, very careful about criticizing the church. Say, preacher, you say that because you're the preacher. No, I don't. I thought about saying, well, they got tired of a boring diet and God got angry. I thought, well, if you get tired of boring sermons, God's going to get angry. No, that's not the point. Be very careful about criticizing the church. And I don't say that because I'm a preacher. I say that because the church is the bride of Christ. The church is the premier object of Jesus' affections. The church is who Jesus died for. The church is what Jesus is building. The church is what Jesus is coming back for. Be very careful about criticizing His bride. But His bride's got problems. Of course. And you work to make His bride more ready. You see, the wilderness was part of God's plan for the Israelites. The local church is part of God's plan for every single believer. Bar none. You say, well, I don't need the church. I'm going to follow God without the church. You can't do it. Jesus died for the church. Jesus is coming back for the church. You don't separate yourself from the church and be pleasing to Jesus. Can't happen. It's part of His plan for all of us. When you hear the grumbling, that's what happens. It is contagious. If that person beside you starts to grumble, starts to complain, the easiest thing to do is to join with them. Say, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. It's probably the easiest thing, but it's probably not the right thing. Maybe turn them back to the big picture. Well, you're right, that's a problem, but let's share the gospel anyway. Let's praise the Lord anyway. Let's help the church anyway. Because that's what Jesus wants. I love the way this author said it. If my God has loved me that much and has paid that price to redeem me from my lostness, how can I complain about the rations He's provided along the way? How can I moan about the company and the conditions of service when Jesus has gone through the valley of death and separation from God on my behalf? God has been so faithful and so good. Keeping your eyes, listen to this, keeping your eyes fixed on the cross will inoculate you against the desire to grumble. I am a sinner saved purely by the grace of God in an absolutely miraculous, stupendous, eternal way. God, help me not ever get I want to show you something really fun. Remember Jesus and the disciples on the road to Emmaus? And he told them all about himself. He said, I'm in there from Moses and all the prophets. Numbers 11, I just know he went there. Because that, Numbers 11 is a picture of Jesus. You say, I don't see how. All you see is God being so angry and this fire from heaven. And that's all I see. No, Jesus is there. You ready to see him? That wasn't very enthusiastic. John chapter 6, a lot of you will be familiar with it. Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. All that manna was a picture of Jesus coming down from heaven to give us what we need. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. That same chapter, we call it the Great Galilean Crisis. Jesus, up to that point in his life, Jesus' popularity had gone just like this. And then after John 6, it takes a nosedive. Because in John 6, Jesus says this, and then he goes on to say things like, if you want to follow me, you got to be willing to drink my blood and eat my flesh. People say, whoa, too expensive. That's just weird. Of course, Jesus wasn't speaking literally. He was saying, you've got to trust me completely. You've got to trust me. What do you? You don't eat anything you don't trust, right? That's one of the most intimate things you can do is take something and put it inside your body. And Jesus said, you've got to trust me completely. And a lot of people said, no, we like the free bread, but we don't want to go any farther than that. Jesus said, I am the way to eternal life.